Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
All right, Mac, thank you for that countdown.
That was a perfect one.
That was great.
Yeah, it was.
The Russian judge gave him a 9-9.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Here we are, middle of turkey season here in Mississippi and Alabama, and everybody looks tired, bloodshot eyes.
It's rained for the last couple of days.
I'm great, man.
Everybody got some rest because it's been raining.
It has. Dudley, you in a good mood?
I'm in a great mood.
That's good to hear.
Just don't say you look like you're in a bad mood.
Yeah. I know better than to do
right,
that.
Right, sure you do.
I always look like I'm in a bad mood, and I'm usually in a good mood.
What do they call that face?
Resting.
We can
resting right Bobby face. Yeah.
Resting Bobby face. Yeah, that would be me.
So, guys, did y'all? But we'll get to introducing our guest here in a second. But did y'all notice that? Did you see that? I thought this was very relevant. Jason Hart cracked 3 teeth.
What?
Eating some turkey meat. He bit down on a TSS.
Son,
pellet.
That stuff is stout.
3 teeth.
Mm-hmm. He must have chewed on it a couple times.
Gamekeeper tip of the week. And actually, Jason Hart was in our camp.
He liked place, turkey hunt, you know.
And he was ironically talking about how that is such a risky thing now. And he was buying a small metal detector to go over his breasts when he fillets them out to be sure there's not TSS. And this is like 3 days ago he was talking about it.
Well, so
man, what's that called? Isn't there a literary term for that?
I'm not, we don't want to throw TSS under the bus. I mean, steel.
Oh, yeah.
Steel will do the same thing.
You don't
want to
chew on any metal.
That's right.
Lead. You know, lead is malleable. I mean, it's soft.
I found out last night.
It'll still kill you.
This young guy that my daughter's dating has a little metal detector. It's about $20.
That's what they're talking about.
And you can just wand over your meat.
Yep, and it'll tell you if you have one.
Yeah.
The problem with TSS is they're all hard. They're all hard. But it's so small that all that pressure is in a smaller area. Oh, yeah. So the intensity on your teeth is probably twice as much.
Good point.
And that's why, and it is so hard on such a small area, that's what makes it more risky.
Mm. So I think bird hunters have been onto this for a little while.
Yep.
So like if you're cleaning a grouse or a quail or something, you want to make sure. So anyway, that's just a little warning, guys. Y'all be careful.
What does the magnet do? Does it stick to the bird and then you dig it out or something?
It's not a magnet. It's a metal
detector. It's a metal
detector,
so you got to dig them in and find
it. Okay, okay.
Yeah, so you could wave it over, and it didn't make any noise, and you know you're good to go.
Yeah, okay.
But then it's just a way to check them, and if it keeps going off, you can actually find them with it.
So looking over at the couch, we got two guys.
They're just smart looking.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they are. So we've got.
They look like they know what they're talking about.
Dr. Bronson Strickland.
In the house once again.
And then the only person I've ever met with the name Mariah, but Mariah Bogus.
Good job.
Happy to be here.
Nice pronunciation. First time in the studio.
When you look at him, Bronson's got this polished head.
A dome.
And Mariah's got more hair than anybody in this room.
Yes.
We offset.
Definitely more than everybody around the table.
Y'all definitely offset.
I'm envious of that head of hair.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I am too.
I resemble that remark too.
Yeah. I miss bangs so bad. You just don't know what you've got under this. Well, we're happy to have you guys in here. We wanted to talk about what anybody, a gamekeeper, can be doing to manage his property this time of year. We know we're all turkey hunting, but we can't not pay attention to what we need to do for deer, turkeys,
absolutely
for our other critters. So we just want to talk about what needs to be going on right now and what are we looking for in the very near future.
Hmm.
And that's, Bronson, when you think about your day-to-day activities, that's – people are asking you this kind of question all the time.
Mm-hmm, certainly. Well, one of the things that I would be doing, and I'm a little bit different. I'm going to be different than Mariah probably in the things he's looking at. Number one thing I'm going to be doing, I'm going to be looking at harvest data. So I'm going to be going back and looking at what are my body weights, my antler trends. I'm going to be figuring out not only was my hunt successful, you know, did we accomplish our objectives? I want to be looking at the trends from my harvest data and what is my population doing? Is it trending up? Is it trending down? Is it right where I want to be? And then once I figure that out, that's going to lead me to what do I need to do to change that? Mm-hmm. So is that going to be habitat projects? Is that going to be a greater deer harvest or a different kind of deer harvest coming up this fall? So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is I'm going to be thinking about my hunt situations and people I was with. Let's assume I'm with a hunting club or a group of people. I'm going to be thinking about what type of disturbance did we have during the hunts? Do we need to move stands around? Do we need to think about different access on the property so we can be more successful in seeing deer and have fewer opportunities to disturb them? And that would be a great project in spring and summer, is especially if you're using box blinds or something like that, is to be able to move those around on the landscape. So yeah. Those are just some really easy projects I think about this time of year.
Sure. Well, dang it, I shouldn't have cemented my post all into the ground in my shooting houses.
So when you, you're talking about managing pressure, you're learning what's putting pressure on the deer, and you're trying to figure out how to take that away.
Yeah.
I think that's smart, for sure.
Yeah, and reflecting on what happened the year before and planning, you know, making your plan, working your plan going forward. He's dead on there. When he said it, I was like, well, God, I need to be thinking about that mm-hmm. right now. I was like, what happened last year? Not necessarily what I want to do this year, but looking at what really happened and what kind of information I can draw from that, which would make me a better gamekeeper.
Yeah, like did your doe weights go up yeah. or down? Things yeah. like that. How many fawns did they have with them?
Right.
Well, we also have the benefit, of course, with all this deer data we get with our research projects too. Mm-hmm. And it's actually something we did a podcast on recently. I don't even know if it's aired yet, but we started looking at throughout the hunting season, just using food plots as a metric for hunting pressure, or what we assume is hunting pressure. Mm-hmm. And when you start out in October and you look at the average time those bucks are entering the food plot, it'll be 30 minutes to sometimes an hour on average before sundown. Mm-hmm. And then the later and later and later you get into the hunting season, until you get into January, you've got more of those bucks are entering the plot after dark. Now, there could be some other things going on there as well, but one of the most obvious things going on is you got 4 months of people putting a whole bunch of pressure yep. on food plots. And not even just the harvest that's taking place there, but the entry and mm-hmm. exit every time you're hunting. Because when we do surveys in Mississippi anyway, and in the Southeast, the single most common place people hunt are directly on food plots. So how can we manage that? How can we change that?
Mm-hmm. I would just anecdotal, but I would say much more intrusive to deer than a gunshot going off to me is the smell of a human being. Mm-hmm. So in and out, leaving all that odor, just incredible how they can smell. I think that's the worst thing yeah. of all, mm-hmm. quite honestly. And the terrible thing about food plots is when you hunt one, you just about can't just keep from disturbing the deer and letting them know you went there. Because typically they're still there when you leave, unless right. somebody, you know, some people are good enough to have someone drive up and come get them and all that. But that's why the magic of a travel corridor is so great, because they pass by and you can get out and hunt it a lot. But the food plot thing is so delicate, and just like you're talking right. about.
You know, it's exciting. It's fun to grow food plots. It's fun to look at the progress, but, you know, I'm bad about it. Yes. You know, I always want to go check on them and yep. walk around in them and look for weeds and good plants and things like that. And yeah, you're leaving your scent everywhere when you do that.
And not to pile on to Bronson's point too much, but I think we all as hunters want to think we're really good about not creating too much pressure. Like we hunt on smart winds, a deer out there, the wind's blowing behind us. But I mean, to his point, it matters where the deer are before they get to the food plot. It matters where they travel from and through. Is your wind blowing through a travel corridor? Is it blowing into a bedding area? But then even more importantly, like Toxie said, I mean, if your stand is sitting, if the legs of your box stand go into the green in the food plot, how do you expect to get out of that stand in daylight? And this is something we see over and over over again, are stands that are set up for failure. I mean, you're not going to get in or out if there's a deer in that field. But if you move that stand, this is a spring project, move it 30, 40 yards into the woods. If you got a nice open pine stand, you got tall grass growing there and goldenrod and whatnot, and it screens you and you're able to get in and out, and you're actually hunting in the trees next to the field, but you can see the field great. Mm-hmm. That is a recipe for success.
Yeah.
It's funny how y'all do make another point, and I'm guilty, so I know it's true for everybody else, is that Bobby checking the food plots on our place where y'all hunt is pressure. But if I'm doing it, it's not pressure.
That's right.
It's funny how you think about anybody, any of your buddies or whoever else being on the place is pressure, but you take for granted. I don't think of it. I just don't think of that I'm creating pressure on them. Mm-hmm. When we're all creating pressure if we're in there.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
The more you're in there.
Mariah, that was a great point. Well, let's learn a little bit about you. My understanding was you were a superstar student at Mississippi State.
He was the golden child.
Mm. I graduated.
Yeah.
I want the knife.
So, I mean, I've just heard nothing but this kid is the most brilliant thing in wildlife management.
Oh, my gosh. Bobby, don't embarrass him.
I didn't know he had. This is awesome.
You gonna let him?
Several years ago, I think Bronson contacted me and asked if they could use one of our acorn collecting machines for one of their students was doing a project on red oaks.
Yeah,
and it was Mariah Bogus, and ever since then that study just made me. I became more interested in the red oak section of oaks, and ever since then, it has just taken off. I mean, I'm still going down the red oak rabbit hole.
Oh, so, yeah,
I am.
Thank
too.
You for that.
And I won't give you my whole life history. You don't need to know, hear it. But I'm from North Carolina, from the mountains there. Went to North Carolina State, and I eventually came to Mississippi State for my master's. And I got to work on oak regeneration and looking at how deer bivory affect plant communities underneath oaks and relation to masting. And that project that Dudley's talking about, the coolest takeaway from that was how delayed deer response to red oak acorns can be. And I say can be, I qualify it because I've seen deer absolutely wear them out as they're dropping. But in this case, they were delaying consumption by a month and a half or two before they really started wearing them out in January. And I've applied that to my hunting since. I mean, I'm a red oak hunting fiend. If I can spend time walking through the woods in December and figuring out where the oaks are, and this is, places even where that's post-rut, I found a lot of success from it. So my, master's research was on that, and that's shaped a lot of the way I hunt and think about wildlife management. From there, I worked for Indiana DNR as their deer biologist for the state and for about a year, and then I went to North Carolina and worked for the Wildlife Commission there for 2 years. And now I'm back in Starkville. I'm now working for this guy.
Who'd you make mad?
So now I have the pleasure of being able to work on private properties, helping landowners achieve the goals that they've set, making their properties as game rich as they can be and really reach those objectives with deer management specifically. Yeah. That's always been my focus and habitat.
100% here. If you had to say you kill more deer or, whatever bucks or good bucks, us or anybody we invite in over an oak tree, 100% by a country mile, number one, for sure it would be nut-alls over frump chestnuts or anything.
That's a good one.
Yep.
It's a good one. It drops late,
too. That's right. On top of what he said. And that's when, I used to kid and call them rut oaks, but they were the only thing still dropping when our rut hits.
No doubt.
We don't have a November. We have a mid-December plus rut.
So I like nut-alls, and I like all the small acorn reds, too, that kind of, they get hit in October, November, but a lot of them end up underneath the leaf layer.
Cherry bark.
And they may even taste better, a month after they fell too.
I mean, like in February when I'm scouting for turkeys, I'm checking every cherry bark and willow oak I can find.
I really like the Schumards, and I'm a little bit partial because that's what my research was with, but I really like Schumards. But we're talking about southern oaks, but for someone in the Midwest or farther north, northern red oaks, that's my favorite tree, bar none, across the board. It's northern red oak, and they drop pretty late. I've seen in Indiana them drop in late November, and they're a real large acorn.
We have a few down here.
Yeah, we
even have some in central Alabama. A few, not many,
but we got them.
So when you did this study, did you touch those acorns? Could that have maybe contributed to the delayed response the deer had on them?
If you drive down Highway 12 right there next to the baseball stadium, there's a couple of Schumards there, and I'm sure Dudley knows them real well. I wore those trees out. I mean, I picked up sacks of acorns using his acorn picker there and other places on campus. So there was absolutely human scent in and around them. And that's one of those variables, you know, there's no way for us to measure it. Mm-hmm. I collected under many different trees, so there's some randomization as to where they came from, and then where they were put out. But, you know, human scent, I obviously was visiting those sites. The way I control for my human scent is that I would visit those sites to put out acorns, but I would also visit later so that, you know, human scent didn't only happen on the ground where we were putting acorns once. It happened throughout the study.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Probably no different than them yellow acorns that have human scent on them.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of places, if they're close to camp, they're probably more used to human scent, too.
More urban areas, for sure. The big city over there.
We love acorns. And just, you know, they're so important to wildlife. Yes, we do. It's just really interesting how...
We love acorns so much, we have a nursery.
Yeah, we do. Yes, we
do. I will say, I'll throw out this plug for acorns and hunting acorns.
Acorns.
And I know Dudley's the oak guy and all. You know, people sleep on hunting acorns.
Oh, yes.
They think about them as a white oak. You hunt during early season and you're done. But I've seen of all the different red oaks as well as white oaks, deer eating them all the way through season.
Quit telling all your secrets.
I've seen deer wear out white oaks even when they have a radical off them. They got a root shooting out the bottom in the snow. I've seen them dig them up and eat them. Yeah. So pay attention to what deer are doing. They'll tell you.
Actually, I believe, it drives over time, especially, kind of, I know it's not like caribou or elk, but there's a migration pattern to our deer here.
100
might not be, but a mile, maybe. I know we've documented 2.5 miles or more.
Oh yeah,
but there's
here,
no question that that winter mass from that in this wooded areas will
affect their movement.
Absolutely. Mm, yeah. We have an area that's got, you know, so many nut aws is wet, and they call it the nut aw woods. My sons do, and for the summer, there won't be a lot of, there'll be deer, but it's the population quadruples.
Yeah.
In, you know, late November, December, January in that area. They migrate there.
Yeah. I've seen that in the hills as well, up on hardwoods. They'll shift.
Mm-hmm. One more question.
Find
then we'll
hot
get,
tree.
We'll get serious. You're from North Carolina.
Yeah.
Have you ever been part of hunting ginseng, digging ginseng?
Not at all. I've actually never found ginseng in North Carolina. I found it in Indiana, and I've actually never picked it, but I've seen it a few times.
Hmm. I need to know what it looks like. I've told we have a place we lease that has wild ginseng on it, but I haven't gone looking for it yet. It
looks a lot like Virginia creeper, just a little bit different.
Gosh. It's kind of like turkeys. If you're not looking, somebody is.
Or morels. Yeah. The minute you start looking, then you start to become paranoid everybody else is.
Yep.
Oh, great.
So if you see a like small morel, if you see a small morel, if you leave it alone, will it turn into a bigger morel? Or do you pick them when you see them?
We don't get them much down here.
I'm kind of like okra. You know, I pick them when I have a chance.
Yeah.
Before they get too big. But I guess some people would wait a few days and go back. But
do we have many this far south?
I think, well, we've heard of, you've found my, one down
my
here.
My former
we?
Family land in central Mississippi. I could clean house out there, but around here.
On morels?
Oh, yeah. In the Golden Triangle area. I've found them, and I have a couple of spots I go and check, but it's, you know, you may find two or three. In the Lurse Hills.
Right, yep.
In Mississippi, that's where you want to be to find them. Or in the... on the other side of the levee on the Mississippi River.
Around here, I've worn out chantrails. Oh, I never got into morels much.
Oh, we've got them in my backyard. Yeah. I've got a Chanterelle Patch, they've picked up 5 gallon buckets of before.
I got it saved on my own X app. Oh, your backyard.
There we go. Hey, shoot that pen over to me, buddy.
No.
All right. So, okay. I'm excited to have you here because I've for years heard nothing but just, man, what a great, smart young guy Mariah is.
And then you saw the hair, and this can't be true.
And he got jealous. And he got jealous.
Yeah, you got. Yeah. So we're excited to have you, Bronson. Thank you for bringing him. So,
yeah, ma'am.
So let's get back to the subject, and I'm going to throw out the first question.
Okay.
Right now, I'm seeing and hearing a lot of people saying that their deer are just suddenly hitting mineral licks every year about this time of the year. Can you kind of explain what's going on there? And I know, you know, I'd like to know your thoughts on mineral licks, because there's most biologists seem to have an opinion, and a lot of people don't agree. Mm-hmm. But what's going on in the spring of the year when they're hitting these mineral sites?
I think that is primarily related to deer are craving sodium or salt. And so notice that is paired with spring green up, and so there's a big diet shift in the deer. They're eating a lot of foods now that are completely full of moisture. Sodium is a vital nutrient for deer. Mm. And so I think it's just coupling with that change of diet, all the moisture that they're getting from the vegetation they're consuming, that they need sodium and they're attracted to it. So I think that's the number one reason that you're seeing the uptick right now.
So if you didn't have a place that a deer could get salt, he would potentially leave your property to go try to find some?
There has been several studies have documented in areas that have natural, you know, salt licks that, yeah, deer will move. And it's not like every day, but once a week or several days in a week, they will move to that and have a feeding bout, so to speak, to get that sodium.
Do you see a lot of natural salt licks? I don't think I've ever seen one.
Not around here, but the further north and east you go, I think you would see them more often, Mariah. You may have seen them in North Carolina.
Yeah, in the mountains. There's a few accounts. I think Virginia of some West studies Virginia. Where yeah. deer shift or move 4 or 5 miles, you know, something like that in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
Remember that photo that I think it was somebody in the Redmond family, but Turbo had some footage of Mike McCloskey of deer walking into a hole in the ground that was a natural salt.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Remember that?
Yeah.
There was one at the cotton mill, actually. Mm-hmm. Oh, used a ton out there. And I think, I'm guessing it may have been, could fertilizer over time have drained and sat or been too much dumped? There was ag field there at one time, but it was just a hole. And it was probably 4 feet deep. Mm. And it was just every year, it would just be inundated with deer tracks.
So as biologists, where do y'all fall on the mineral lick thing? And where I'd like to go is even if you say we don't know or we don't understand, but could we potentially, I mean, couldn't there be some value from these micronutrients that are being offered?
You want me to start?
I'll go and then you can play cleanup. Could there be? There's been research that couldn't prove it, that tried to prove some benefit in advanced age classes of having access to supplemental minerals, and there was no effect. Science is all about replicating research, and it probably needs to be replicated a few more times, you know, to have a really firm understanding of no. But as of right now, I wouldn't tell a landowner to spend money and resources on that with the expectation of increasing antler size. If I'm in an area where, you know, there's been enough surveillance, I don't think CWD is a concern, then putting it out really shouldn't, there should be no detriment to it, right? So it's like, okay, well, if it's very little cost and you want to do it, maybe you want to just put it out to get photos of deer. If I ever put out any kind of salt in the summer or a mineral lick, it's really with the expectation that I just want to get some regular, consistent photos of bachelor groups. Mm. In that case, you know, I would tell somebody, yeah, go ahead, but not with the expectation that I'm going to actually increase the antler size. Because if you want to increase antler size on your property, we've got a whole laundry list of things you should be doing that we know that we can prove work.
Yeah.
And we should do those first.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
We'll get to those. But what about, instead of like just totally focusing on antler size, what about just saying the health of the animal, mm-hmm. buck and doe? I mean, could you probably couldn't tell if it's helping or hurting.
Yeah.
It'd be difficult. So one thing that I think a
Do
lot
y'all
of
take vitamins.
I have started taking a supplement.
Yeah.
Mariah,
Mariah saying no.
Yeah. And that was actually a little story or anecdote I used to say years ago, and so I guess I am changing a little bit, is a physician has always said, if you have a really good, high-quality, well-balanced diet, you do not need to take a supplement or a vitamin.
That's right.
Because you're getting it from your food. But then we always like, well, I'm just going to help out. It's insurance. I'm going to go ahead and take it. But really, the one thing I see a lot that, in my opinion, I think a lot of people are missing is that not recognizing that those minerals that are used to grow antlers, they're found in the plants that deer eat. The phosphorus and the calcium and the potassium and, of course, the protein. Everybody talks about the crude protein, but all those other minerals are found in the tissue of plants that deer evolved to eat. And so they are definitely getting a lot of that. Might you also want to supplement for insurance? You know, I can't say you should or should not, but as Mariah indicated, because it's a very complicated study to do, but no one has ever demonstrated, here's what the average antler size was before, here's the average antler size after, and there was a big significant jump. Because it's so hard to control what was the animal's diet. Were they already getting it from the plants they were eating?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like supplements too, Bobby, just because you read the label and it has whatever 29 essential vitamins, doesn't mean they're all readily absorbable or what kind of form they're in. And I'm sure the same thing with those minerals. They may or may not be readily absorbable. And to the point they can really get them and ingest them like every day, like they need them every day. So, you know, it makes sense, honestly, that it might not be. I just know that deer have got to replace, the bucks have got to replace all that phosphorus and calcium and whatever elements are in their horns every year. Remember one of our old biologist buddies used to say, imagine you cut your legs off at the knees every year and had to grow it back. You would have to have so much extra.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know,
they're doing,
you know, antler deer do. So it's hard to believe that it doesn't help some, but I think what I hear him saying is be caution anybody that's selling you like a magic bean.
See these people? When the clock strikes five, it's not the end. It's just the beginning. They have to do these things. They have to do those things. Enter the all new LS Tractor MT2 and MT2E. A relentless force of innovation, redesigned with a new hood and cab built for comfort and visibility, with enhanced lifting capacity to get the job done. Making these people the ones everyone else calls those people. Visit your local LS Tractor dealer today.
Moultrie has pioneered the game management category. Today, Moultrie is one of the best-selling brands of feeders and seeders in the world, and they continue to innovate with new technology that gamekeepers will rely on. Moultrie products are always field-tested and designed for hunters by hunters, combining forward-thinking innovation with time-tested practicality. Moultrie, first in feeders since 1979. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount.
It reminds me a lot about crops and micronutrients. You know, a lot of those microbes are there just to keep the plant, you know, from dying if there is a deficiency. But having it present doesn't necessarily make the plant grow more.
Right.
It just makes it keep its health in layman's terms.
Yeah, because I mean, I take from what they're telling us, and I think we've heard it before too. And I think from him some. Is that if you're doing everything else right, you know, right. And the carrying capacity of your place is in balance and they're getting a lot from it, it probably can help some. But when people buy that and think that's all they have to do, that's what we, I think, are trying to educate people is don't expect that to change your life.
Yeah. And I was just trying to come at it from a, not expecting to see antler growth, but just thinking I might be helping make both does and bucks.
Yeah.
Well, some of our experiences at Port Landing when we got that place, it was devoid of food plots and there was a high deer density, but the bucks had a lot of broke off tines. Now, to your point, we put in food plots and mineral licks and we changed that over time, but I don't know if it was the mineral licks or the food plots or a combination of both.
But
we did see a change. Not bigger deer, but they just weren't broke off all the time.
Well, they were bigger.
And the body weight, body weights went up.
Body weights did get bigger.
And those deer, it was all brassica driven back then.
Yeah.
100%. I remember it well.
All right, Dudley, I'm going to let you have the next question.
Okay. Well, Austin James asked, what are cheap habitat improvements for the summer?
Budget conscious.
Yeah.
I can appreciate that.
Budget conscious habitat improvements us gamekeepers can be doing in the summertime.
I'll give to Mariah and then you can chime in here. I would say fire. And I would say forest stand improvement. Getting in there with a chainsaw and getting some sunlight on the ground.
I love doing all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, talk about that a little bit more. I mean, are you trying to just reduce the canopy to get sunlight to the ground, basically?
Yes, but you're also targeting specific trees. So, I mean, you do need to put in some homework and looking at what is this species of tree. And then you've got two ways you can go with that. You know, from a wildlife value. And then if it's of timber value, monetary value, that may be important to you or not. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially looking at, of all these trees in front of me, which ones do I want to keep? Which ones are not doing anything for wildlife? Mm-hmm. And let's take those out. Mm-hmm. And then two things are going to happen. You're going to increase the canopy and the growth of the trees you want to keep and also acorn production. And then you're also going to get sunlight on the ground. So now you're adding food and cover to the landscape there.
Gotcha.
What do you do with that tree that you cut down? Do you just leave it there? Or are you pulling it out?
You girdle it.
Well, so when you say with a chainsaw, you're just girdling. You're not cutting the tree down.
You can do both.
Yeah.
You can do both. You can cut it down, lay it down, fell it, or you can girdle it and let it stand.
Are you leaving it lay there if you fell it?
If it's a good tree for firewood, I might use it for firewood. But yeah, I'm not doing anything with it from a wildlife management perspective.
You know, like the mineral stump thing that Marcus worked on a couple years ago, that would be a case of where you would cut it off either at the base or a foot or two high, and you're letting the deer eat the regrowth.
Yep,
but
yep.
Maybe it's a species you don't want there. And in that case, you would probably cut it and then treat it with a herbicide to keep it from resprouting. Or, you know, some trees, when they get to be a certain diameter, a lot of oaks, I think Dr. Ezel taught us when they get to be above about 10 inches in diameter, they don't resprout anymore. So I think you just kind of have to know your species and go from there.
And for the ones that will resprout, girdling, you definitely want to put herbicide in it. Yeah. I've tried and tried with multiple girdles, and it's so impressive that tree just grows right around them.
Oh, yeah. I had a mulberry in my yard. Granted, I would never kill a mulberry out in the woods. I love them. But it was growing next to my house, and I double girdled it, and it lived through it.
Hmm.
It's crazy.
When you're talking about double girdle, two rings. Two rings, yeah. Through the bark, and was it cambium?
Yeah. You do an inch deep.
I went to Mississippi State, too.
It goes around it.
What'd you have for lunch today?
I can't remember.
He stayed in the hot
Osmosis.
Day
Osmosis.
That's interesting. Mac, you're sitting over there being quiet, but you make me think you got a question.
Yeah, so I'm looking at some of the questions the listeners sent, and one of them from Matthew Lee asked, are there stages of the spring and summer that clover is more palatable and nutritious? I would assume that will vary on the type of clover, but that wasn't in the question.
Yeah. You want me?
Yeah, you go for it.
Okay. The way I very simply would explain that would be, they're going to be our different clovers with different maturation dates throughout the year. And so they are going to be most palatable during this rapid growth period. So that is when they're going to be allocating nutrients, less fiber, they're more digestible. Once they reach maturity and they stop growing structurally and start allocating resources to growing seed, flowering, etc., their palatability is going to decrease. So I can't say, you could say a particular month if you said it a particular clover, but it would just depend on the clover you're talking about, when is their period of rapid growth. So it's going to be that month before their maturation.
So like crimson clover right now, you're seeing it just go to bloom.
Yeah, it might have already passed. That's yeah. To me, the downside of crimson clover, it's at its best when there's so much to eat on top of it, and it's really not as necessary, mm-hmm. unless you're in a really, you know, bad situation for your brow. So
yeah. Well, clover, and right now, guys need to be thinking about spraying if they hadn't already before
someone. 100%. We're spraying right now.
So he made the case for these, you know, the whites and ladinos, especially like non-typical. It seems like what he's saying is when they're growing and regrowing, they're the most nutritious. Well, guess what? Unlike other stuff, you know, they eat a clover, three more, replace that. They're made for grazing. And honestly, the heavier they're grazed, the better they last, as long as they aren't, you know, eaten mm-hmm. to the ground completely. So seems like to me that makes such a great case for clovers because they're eating them and they regrow and they regrow. And so there's fresh growth all the time if they're grazing it well.
So I have a question on the grazing aspect. So I know that there's the argument of whether you should clip your clover and how that benefits and the tonnage per acre and if you have heavy weeds, when to do it. But is it fair to say if you clipped your clover, the regrowth would make that clover more palatable at a time when it normally wouldn't be?
Would it make it last longer?
Or more palatable?
Yeah, no, I'm asking.
Like, so you could cut it to decide when you want it to be most attractive.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good question. That was covered, I think, very well by Craig Harper and his team at the University of Tennessee looking at that question. And what they found, now there's an assumption here. They do a very, very good job preemptively of controlling all the weeds. So a lot of the management prescription for mowing of the clover is you're dealing with all these weeds as well. So they had already controlled for that. And so the way that they examined this was they wanted to look at the quality and biomass throughout the year compared to mowed plots and unmowed plots and simultaneously looking at deer visitation. And if I remember the details correctly, they found out it, in their area where they didn't have to mow for weeds was that they had more biomass production and more high quality biomass produced in the plots or the areas that were unmowed. As a result, they had greater deer visitation on those plots. Am I remembering that correctly, Mariah?
I even remember that from him being here. Yes.
Yeah, we were fascinated by his.
Yeah, but again, he sprayed, but he did not necessarily mow.
Yeah, he was talking about park to bush hog.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the things that you, especially grass is grass, but the things that your broadleaf herbicide will kill and leave on clover is something like clover. So you're getting pretty much any legume and quite a few forbs left. And those are typically the most beneficial native plants, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, he was just saying, and I think there's something to be said about some of those growing in your clover. They're not really hurting the yield or anything, and it's a little bit of shade for poults. And then they, make, you know, and I think deer feel more comfortable grazing amongst a little bit of cover than just a flat, wide-open field, I think, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Mariah, we've had a lot of luck with spraying clover. We've got a liquid fertilizer that it's just, you can just see the clover respond to it. And you can actually, I think the neatest thing is, I don't know how this technology works, but your herbicide, you can actually, I think the terminology is stack them on top of each other. So one pass, you're fertilizing and spraying. That's pretty efficient.
I think it enhances the uptake. So it's your herbicide works better. And it's foliar intake. So it's immediate. Doesn't have to get in the soil either. Yeah.
So I was going to say one thing just to tack on, you know, if we're thinking about palatability, Bronson was talking about, you know, those annual clovers. So crimson being a great example, it's going to seed right now. It has foliage available to deer, but that's going to be gone really quick. And it's already palatability has gone way down. Crimson went through its prime time in the last few weeks, as far as productivity and the peak amount of forage available for deer. But if you're growing annual food plots, if you diversify the annual clovers you have in there, so you got crimson clover, bursine, balanza, red clover, you have some of these different maturation dates. We've got crimson just hit its peak. Then we've got balanza coming after it. We've got bursine. We've got so on. And then we hit with red clover. That gets us all the way into mid to late summer before our clovers are played out. So it doesn't have to be just a one and done if you approach it right.
Benefit of a blend, no doubt.
Good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. We're big fans of clovers.
Oh, absolutely. Me too. Don't get me started.
Yeah. We really like – in fact, we need to show you some of our stuff, Mariah. I think you it's pretty impressive. And Kenny Thompson up in Jackson, Tennessee, not very far from here, he's got some stuff that's 10 years old. Where were you 10 years ago? Mariah, where were you 10 years ago?
Hey, we talk about the goat of clover growing. He may be the goat.
Yeah, you know,
it's amazing. Sure, he really is.
Well,
amazing.
He's making us go broke because we can't sell him anymore.
Yeah, he bought some 10 years ago and hadn't been back. Yeah,
but he manages it is the key to it.
So. And he does oversee.
Yeah, he does. Lanny, you got a question?
Yeah, it's about kind of back on the protein thing. We have a question here. Is there any benefit to only part-time protein feeding during antlergenesis or peak antler growing months?
This is a question from a viewer or someone?
Yeah, from a listener, A Warfel 3.
So I'm assuming you're talking about supplemental feeding protein. Mm-hmm. So I would say if you're going to do it, and you want to maximize the opportunity for the greatest return on your investment, then I would do it all the time. I mean, that's when you would see the greatest result. If, however, because of budgetary constraints, I'm only going to do it during part of the antler growing season, I would recommend you do it in the last half, not the front half. Front half, you're going to have spring green up, all the food plot stuff we're talking about there. It's going to be that, especially if you did not have warm season food plots. Now, if I've got a warm season food plot full of soybean or whatever, I don't think it's necessary.
Right.
Well, I think you'll find, having done that, I think you'll find that consumption will vary greatly depending on what else they have, because they would rather browse than anything, regardless of a deer feed. But use a really good brand that you know, and you'll notice that when they won't eat much, if you had a lot of soybeans and clovers, the consumption won't be much. So it's really not that much more to feed year round because they're not going to eat it when they've got, eat much.
Yeah.
But in years like we had last year, we had a complete and total devastating drought. And it makes a big difference then.
Let's go back to your list. What's another thing that's on y'all's list that y'all are having clients do this time of year?
Oh, go ahead, Mariah.
To qualify this question as something I wanted to bring up in this chat is it's real easy to approach this, what should we be doing this time of year, from the standpoint of maybe an assumption that all of our ducks are in a row, I've got a property and things are kicking, and so I'm kind of in a maintenance stage, for lack of better words. Most properties that we work on, it's the reason we're there, but 90% of them or more, they've got a lot of work to go before they get to that maintenance stage. And so
that's us. We don't even know where all our ducks are.
So I just to point it out, if there is low hanging fruit that you haven't addressed, you can spin your wheels a lot trying to be in the maintenance phase when you haven't even got your trees cut. For instance, you haven't initiated the biggest change that you can have on your property. So like we've got a couple, properties right now where all we're doing there is we are trying as hard as we can to talk a logger into getting out there. Cause if we can get a logger on site this summer to knock out a few hundred acres of trees, we are going to move mountains on that place that we would, and we could spend so much time otherwise doing all these other things, that won't add up to as much as that timber. And that's not to detract from all the other things we do besides timber management. But when you're looking at a property, it's always what's the lowest hole in the bucket. And so, if you don't have your trees cut, it's the timber. Once you got your trees cut, then we're starting to look at these summer food plots and getting some supplemental food out there for deer. right now it would be summer food plot planning, you know, and to piggyback on what Bronson said before, if we have any FSI projects for the summer, getting those identified, we don't want to start cutting those trees till about midway through summer, because you want to do it when all the sap is starting to begin heading south. But you can do a lot of work on the front end to get your trees all, you know, get your trees flagged where logger crews are going to be in there, or an FSI crew is going to be in there, identifying what you want to keep and not keep. So, you know, right now, if I'm not planting food plots, I'm preparing for what's going to happen next. And there's a lot you can do there.
Yeah.
SFI. Is that what
Forest
FSI.
Stand Improvement.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, some people say timber.
TSI.
Yeah, okay.
The only, and that's just, you know, it's a technicality. Timber stand improvement implies that you're managing for timber. We're really all about managing the forest for deer, because we're not timber producers. So if we were, the timber stand improvement is generally if you're going in there and you're actually taking out trees, think about it pre-commercial thin. You're doing that for the purpose of producing better pole timber, you know, down the road. That is TSI.
Okay.
This is forest stand improvement.
But you can do both, actually.
Yeah, they're same activity for the most part. Different intention.
And let me add one of the most nap-inducing, eye-rolling activities that I have to say all the time. Now is the time to deal with it. Get ag lime on your food plots that you're getting ready for fall. Yes. Now you got all summer logistically to get it in there and time for it to begin neutralizing your soil.
Great point.
Don't wait until August or September and then That's right. Too late, or I bring it in and now the buggy's everywhere and you can't get. Do it right now.
Good point. I'm ready. I got my money in my sock drawer and I'm just waiting on some dry weather.
There you go.
Lenny, I had to tell you, hunting with you, you've got your phone in your pocket. You're constantly checking Onyx.
Yep. Very valuable key features all in those things. It really is. From the compass mode to recent imagery, I mean, it really helps you understand where you are spatially, where you're headed, where a turkey is, where he was. It's a heck of a tool to use in the spring woods.
I didn't realize that they're updating these maps every couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'd have never known about that clear cut that you were hunting if I didn't have that recent imagery.
Well, you know, and you could share some waypoints with me.
I could share some points with you. With you. You're exactly right.
I mean, it has that capability.
It does have that sharing capability, which is great. You know, you're wanting to show me where your goblin turkeys are.
Oh, man. You know, Onyx, it's a great app.
It's a great app.
So guys can go to onyxmaps.com/hunt and use code Mossy Oak to get 20% off.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of Onyx.
I am too.
Have you taught him the "it depends" answer yet?
Oh, he knows it quite well. Quite well.
I hear it quite a bit.
Lanny, you got another question?
Sure. Let's see here. I really don't. Jump back on there.
Toxic. You have never been at a lack of questions for anybody.
Me? I just asked the last one. I wasn't ready for number two yet.
So while y'all think, I got a question.
There you go. We knew you did. I was going to ask your question.
So let me ask this to Mariah. Turkey season is going on right now. I'm still seeing bucks with antlers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I've got, Todd Amenrud, editor of our magazine, lives in Minnesota. His deer shed around, I think, the end of the year, around Christmas, their deer shedding.
Yep.
You love to hunt shed antlers. So this question is tailor-made for you. His deer rut, they come out of velvet about the same time our deer come out of velvet. Are they getting a longer growing season on their antlers than we're getting?
So I think I'm going to give my answer to this purely based on observations, and I'm going to let Bronson play cleanup if I say something here that he can disprove with data. As a shed hunter, I've talked to a lot of people all over the country that shed hunt and have different shed timing, different shed drop windows. And you know, there's places in the Midwest where antlers are dropping January consistently every year. Down here, I'm wasting my time looking for sheds until the first week of March. You'll get a couple in the last week or so of February, but it's a lot more delayed. And so with that parallel, it's easy to jump to the conclusion that's tied directly to the breeding season. You know, it's breeding season's later, therefore they shed later. And that's probably part of it. But from what I've seen, you know, that variations, even within a state, you might have a month of variation in antler shed dropping, but that might not correlate directly to a month in variation in peak breeding date. I think there's a lot of fluctuation there across space as to when bucks shed, And it's pretty unique as to where you're at, as in, like, I could be here in Starkville, and usually around the first week of March, that's when the antlers are dropping. There might be other places in Mississippi, it's 2 weeks later, say, and there might not be really an appreciable difference in the rut timing. So what I see is that is kind of a unique window that's tied more so to a smaller population. I've even seen counties where there's at least a 2 or 3 week lag across the county from one area to another, and there's no real difference in rut timing. In breeding time, I should say. And so just my observations, it's highly variable across population, across state, across region. Generally from that January through late March timeframe, but I don't have any cause and effect as to why. I think that it's likely tied to breeding chronology. It's tied to that same cycle that is velvet shedding, because all of these processes are regulated by testosterone, right? Antler hardening, antler shedding, or testosterone rises, velvet comes off, testosterone drops, antler shed. Like it is tied to the testosterone cycle in deer. But as to what's causing it to drop at a certain time, aside from an injury or some kind of acute issue with a deer that will cause them to drop prematurely, I don't have a satisfying answer.
So Bobby wanted you to tell him that the people up north have
bigger antlers
because they have about 2 or 3 weeks of growing time more than the deer in the south.
You know what I see happening is that in those places where they start budding earlier, they stop elongating earlier. I've seen time or places where they'll hold what are pretty much fully grown antlers for, you know, a month before they actually mineralize and the velvet comes off. So that starting earlier, I wouldn't assume actually leads to any kind of change in antler size.
Okay, well, that's
I think it was a great question.
Well, I can ask it. So typically, I mean, the bigger deer of the Midwest than the South, I know we have some really big deer in places, but on average, it's just they've evolved to a bigger body survival over the years, taller, bigger, stronger to make it through the winters. Bigger bone structure. Bigger bone structure means bigger antlers, which are bone, right?
Yeah.
That pretty much it?
Bergman's rule. Farther north you go.
And there's something you've always said about the latitude.
Yeah, that's essentially. So we see a relationship with just what Toxie was saying, where bigger bodies are associated with more northern latitudes or climates. Mm-hmm. And that is for, we think, heat conservation. But we also have to think of a southern deer. So where we're at, and certainly further south, heat dissipation is really advantageous for them. So, you know, we don't see 350-pound deer in South Florida.
Right.
You know, that'd be a death sentence for a deer. And so we see a typical gradient from south to north with body size like that. But then it's also influenced within a latitude. So if you just go across the Midwest, we then see another relationship with nutrient availability. Mm-hmm. So if you went from Pennsylvania all the way over to Iowa, the places where you have greater nutrition, greater diet quality, those deer are bigger. Mm-hmm. So you got two things working in concert there.
Body size and available nutrition.
Right. Heat dissipation, heat conservation, and then nutrient availability.
I will just tack on to the antler shed question. They do seem to drop at a very similar time from year to year. They might fluctuate from, you know, a week or two, as in like the peak antler drop in an area. But it seems to be rather consistent even in a small subpopulation. I'm talking like property level.
So do y'all think like a 1.5-year-old deer, does he shed earlier than a 5-year-old deer? Is there a statistic on that?
All the shed hunters say the bigger antler deer drop sooner.
That's what I've always thought too.
I've also seen enough big antler deer hold their antlers late that I say it's random. But I've also seen big ones shed earlier.
Yeah.
I would just say, and especially Bobby would back me up with this, in Alabama I've seen sheds at the very 1st of February. I've seen deer with their antlers in the 1st of April. Crazy. Mm-hmm. Not much.
Yeah.
That's rare there. But I see quite a few around the 1st of March still. So pretty random where here, I think it's much less random. It seems like they all come off at more of the same time. It's kind of strange how widespread it is in one area but not in another.
So just one last question around the dropping their antlers. I'm trying to read a little bit about it. And is there like so their testosterone drops. But then from what I was reading, there's like a little slight infection that eats away at the glue, if you will, that's holding that antler there. And that's what eats away and then the antler drops.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it an infection, but yeah, a chemical process happens where those cells that are holding the antler to the pedicle, yeah, they essentially dissolve. And that's when the antler falls off. So it is kind of a chemical process.
And then it's just a kind of a bloody, almost a wound right yeah. there. Mm-hmm. How long does it take that to heal over?
I think it's basically scabbing over in a couple days. And then you'll have a couple weeks or maybe sometimes a month before you'll then see it growing again.
Yeah.
I've watched that with Lucky, you know, at the deer mm-hmm. pen. Is it that starts as a full-size scab and then it just closes in, and just like if you have a real big wound on your arm or something and there's a scab and it closes in and then you get that last little button and then it eventually pops off and then it's smooth. I mean, it looks the exact same way on the antler.
Interesting. I've got one, Bobby, a question, but it's more I've heard this and so you can debunk it or not. And a couple of people, but especially one guy, I won't call a name, was a really good property manager for someone who has a big track. And one of his favorite things to do, he did it early on, there was a main road going through the place that wasn't very daylight. He extra daylighted that road and cut timber on it and actually, you know, sold the timber off each side a little bit more. And his first thing, because it ran all the way through the place, and he did it on some side roads, and he would just take his fertilizer buggy and fertilize, you know, he would set it where it spent it far as he could out. He would just fertilize all his roads. So he was getting daylight that he didn't have with the fertilizer. And he thought that was the best money he could spend before he did anything else. Take a shot. I don't know. Does that make sense or not?
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. You're probably going to see the biggest change in the biomass of the plants. So the plants are going to get bigger. And you'll probably see a little bit of effect depending on the nutrients in the soil and the quality of the plants.
Right.
Sure.
Thought it made, he swore by what a difference it made. Of course, the landowner liked to ride through and see animals. And he says, well, they see more because they're all, the plants taste better. They're more nutritious and they're all out on the roadsides. Mm-hmm. But the main thing was he was just creating sunlight and whatever native plants were there. And I guess he had some colonization of really good plants too.
Yeah.
Just a thought where it might be. And it's really easy. You know, you pass through one time and you're done.
Mariah, did you grow up hunting?
Didn't really start till I was about 13, kind of found it on my own. No one in my family hunts. And so, whenever I found it, I was just, you know, all in. That's been nonstop ever since.
Yeah. He was telling us over lunch, but you were at the other end of the table, but, he found his shed. Found a shed, and that's kind of what sparked his interest in the whole thing.
Yeah. Shed hunting is my first true love. And it still wins out over deer hunting.
Oh, wow.
As much, and anyone who knows me, I know I love to deer hunt, but if I could choose to shed hunt, that's what I'd be doing.
Oh my gosh. Is that right?
Well, you're just you're a mobile person. You like to get out and walk around and explore, and so I get it.
I can appreciate that.
So you're a young guy, and you think about when you kind of look globally at the deer herd that we've got right now, where are we in the good old days? Are they behind us? Are they in front of us? What do you think?
Oh, I think we're in the good old days. I think this is, I can't imagine 30, 40 years down the road looking back and thinking that things got better than this. Hmm. Maybe that's for lack of imagination, but when I look at all the trends, everything from deer population size at every state level, at their max, I can't imagine them getting much larger, especially with human population, you know, and just development. The age structure of bucks nationally, doesn't matter where you look, that is going up. Some states a lot quicker than others, but across the board, there's more big deer to hunt. There's more deer to hunt. As a deer hunter, I can't imagine living at a better time.
Yeah, you know, and you have to give kudos to, and Bronson's partly responsible for this. I hate to give him the specific kudos, but Mississippi has one of the best rates of our hunters are targeting older deer.
Yeah, that's right.
And I mean, that's something to be proud of.
Remember how mad people were when all that stuff first went down?
People were furious. I've been bragging a lot about Mississippi and that we've stepped forward before any state as far as listening to our biologists. We're the first state to put antler restrictions on deer.
Mm-hmm. How about
We're the first state. Say it. And it was, like Dudley said, it was a national teeth that we were so not thinking about the little guy. Well, guess what? The little guy, if you want to call it that, you know, the guy with a bunch of people in his, they were the first ones to benefit more. Mm-hmm. And then we're the first one to make a Jake illegal, except for kids. Hit them again.
I still remember
it was so much noise about that. It's so, oh my gosh, all I can do is hunt public land. Well, guess what? Within a year or two, the hunting on public land just shot to the top better because there was more goblin turkeys and more competition and more long beards. And so I just, not that I'm saying we're right or wrong or different. I'm just really proud that we've been able to listen to our biologists largely, not always, here. And it seems to have, Alabama's done a good job. You know, they're moved their turkey season back. That's a different subject. But I'm just proud to say that we listen to the biologists.
People are doing some change.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at theferminator.com.
Hey guys, Dudley from Gamekeepers here. I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
And it's exciting. I think our better days are still ahead, but it's going to be specific to how different people handle their place.
Yeah. Mariah, as a young guy, looking at all this, though, there's never been more interest in people trying to do the right thing and looking to people like you guys and Bronson specifically that through the years, being able to give great advice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? I've messed it up enough times and getting frustrated to go, you know what? I need to pay attention to what researchers have found.
And I'll say too, the younger generation, I think we got a lot of hope in them too, because the mentality of a hunter is a little bit changed than it was in the 90s. We talk about it all the time.
Yeah,
you know how it was.
Well, think about it. You were stuck with whatever had happened,
right,
by osmosis, by clubs not knowing any better, and the old 8 points or better rule, and they were just high grading the best deer. Even before that, they shot everything with horns. So it was just a chance when you went. Now the kids grow up in a club that is taking matters in their own hands.
Right.
And they learn the nuances of deer management. Maybe not like a graduate, but they learn early. I mean, think about today when I went, if it had antlers visible above hairline, buddy, it went down. My dad says I was a 3-year-old. We're going to let him walk, you know.
Mariah, give us a shed hunting tip.
In the South.
It's going to be overly simplified because I think people overthink shed hunting. You got to be where there's bucks.
sounds like a plan.
You hear all these tips of like, oh, you got to walk creek jumps and fences.
Tell me, Onyx.
You just got to be where there's bucks.
Yeah, but tell me Onyx is not a great tool to grid where you've been and all that.
Yeah, I love using a little line if I'm gridding something out. But most of the time, I'm just walking straight lines, hitting as many broad areas as I can to find the deer.
Do you walk trails? No, we find a deer trail, you'll walk it.
I will if I think it's a good, you know, good spot, or if I'm walking between areas. But I target food sources to start. But really, if I'm doing it right, if I'm there leading up shed season, I'm running cameras. I've always shed scout. I find way more sheds when I've got my plans already. Because you only got a week or two, especially around here with green up where it's prime. You want to know where there's bachelor groups of bucks, where to spend your time, because otherwise you're just kind of walking willy-nilly hoping you run into them. And they are concentrated in the small areas where there's winter food. And sometimes it's mostly does and young bucks, and other places there might be a bachelor group or two with older age class bucks. And I love to figure that out ahead of time if I can. That really helps your chances.
Hmm. You ever walked up to like a fence crossing and there lays two antlers?
No. Maybe that's why I'm salty about it. It hasn't happened. I've found one near a fence before, but I don't even know if it was related. Hmm.
I can tell you he's really into this shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm at 53 for the year, and my goal was 50, so I'm happy now. Oh, I'm satiated until next spring.
How many miles do you think were for those 53 horns?
I don't know for this year. Normally, I average a little over 200. Mm. It's usually around 4 miles per an antler.
Yeah.
I had one day this year that was so good. I found like, I think I walked 13 miles and found like 9 or 10. That was probably my best average, you know. Yeah. Yeah. That's what helps the days when I walk 10 and don't find anything.
I think Toxie told us he found 12 one day this year. Nine.
Okay. We were riding, but it was what made it so great was my wife and I and our 3 granddaughters. Yeah. And since the ATV we had wouldn't crank, we jumped into the
Argo.
Argo, yeah. And so we rode off in a couple of duck ponds, you know, and that was fun for them, whatever. And I'd burned off a couple of big fields, and my wife's like, look, there's an antler. And sure enough, and it was a deer we had pictures of. It's a pretty big 10 point. He's wide, heavy, just wasn't real tall, but a beautiful deer. And I said, that's the deer, you know, Neil was talking about. You know, we had the game warden shot does one day, and he took a picture of the deer because they were just shooting does. But we're familiar with in the area. But, you know, he'd evaded people all season other than that. And she said, let's find the other side. I said, the chances of that are so dim. And but I think that there's a better chance if it was a bigger, heavier antler that his head might be a little more lopsided. Maybe it comes off sooner. We'll know. So it was really close to where we had a pretty lush food plot. We call it the test plot, actually. So let's go over there. We found 6 more in that big, long food plot. And it's about 500 yards long. It's a big food plot. And we found the matching set to that one about 250 yards from that, which she had found. And so over the course of just going ahead and driving all our food plots, we found a total of 9. But it was with my granddaughters, who were from 7 to 4 to 1.5. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it so much fun.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't have, you know, because even if I saw one riding around slow, I just kept my mouth shut. There's one. And they bounce out of there and run across the field to pick them up. Yeah, I had the best time. That was really cool.
Bronson, looked like you were going to say something just a second ago.
Yeah, but it was a little bit about the topic earlier about the good old days. Mariah has a great story that we find fascinating because we're looking at data, like we're talking earlier about. I'm looking at your harvest data, your observation data, your average antler size, and everybody, not everybody, a lot of people, they're just not satisfied. And in the good old days, you know, and we're telling them like, you are in the good old days. Oh, yeah. But Mariah, you told me with your experience with the state wildlife agencies, y'all would do surveys and ask them about this past year versus 5 years ago. What was that response you would commonly get?
So I'll say it was in Indiana. They do a survey up there every year. And one of the questions, and I forget the exact wording, it's how is hunting now compared to 3 years ago or 5 years ago? It's one of the two. And every single year, a wide majority of people say, oh, it's worse than it's ever, you know, it's worse than it was. It's bad. These are things I'm unhappy about. And that's consistent year after year after year. People are saying, oh, it used to be better. It used to be better. It used to be better. But when you look at the harvest is stable. Buck age structure is better than it's ever been. Hunter success rates are as good as they've ever been. All of the metrics, you know, when you look fine scale, they're better than they've ever been. It's never been a better time to be a deer hunter out there, especially if you value, you know, being able to hunt an older age class buck. But I think oftentimes human condition is we think, oh, you know, we look at the past and we remember the good times, maybe not the bad times. And we think, oh, you know, we got it so much harder today, but man, today is the day to be a gamekeeper, to be, you know, a hunter. Mm-hmm. We've got so much, we're already at such a good starting point. If you're coming into a property, you do a couple things and you can really aim for the fence. And as a, you know, younger hunter, I'm super happy to be where I am now and have the ability, you know, to live here and hunt and do all those things. And I hope to be able, you know, to pass that on. And I think that maybe some hunters, you know, it's kind of lost on them. You know?
Well, you know, I think he speaks to the human condition. That's a little exactly bit of natural psychology.
Right there.
So there are just some people that can't be happy. And I hate to say it, they're programmed to kind of self-destruct and all of a sudden be unhappy. and they're, you know, whether it be, you know, at home or with friends or job or whatever, or even the hunting. So it manifests itself. It's sad to say that you had a majority of people say that, because we are definitely in the good old days.
Yeah.
And they would say that. It's just, I think those are the people that just in general are negative, however you want to say that.
Yeah.
I bet you there's a lot to do with that.
There's more opportunity than any of us have time to get to out there.
Yeah, you're exactly right there. What did Bud say about the, what was it about the conditioning things? It's not as,
oh, I forgot now.
I did too. Mark that time, go take that out of there. I'm going to get it before it's over with.
Well, do you think that it's a lot of people are like, there's more people parked at gate, there's more people hunting on public ground, and they're having to compete with those guys, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, back in the day, I was only one parked here.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it. And I end up hunting a lot of national forests, and I find myself in that situation. Shed hunting the same. I'll find myself, I'm like, oh, I'm competing against more people than ever because it's becoming so popular. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is there's more deer to find antlers off today than ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the optimistic view.
All those guys that are out there buying licenses and money's going back to the resource. So,
I'm
the same way.
Yeah, and we do. And other things, it's turkeys, deer, ducks, all of those. That's kind of the big three to some degree. Fishing, it has actually some – we can have a downturn because of weather conditions. Yeah. I mean, I've said before, you know, we take someone hunting and we've got this place we've been managing, or we go to a friend of ours or somebody, it's just swimming with a big deer, and someone comes on a trip or whatever and hunts for 3 or 4 days, and it's like, good gosh, there's nothing here. Well, you could have the best place in the world. If they're not moving, you're not going to see any deer.
100%.
Same way with turkeys. I mean, if, you know, the weather's terrible, they're probably, if they're gobbling, you probably won't hear them anyway. And if it stays these really warm winters, we don't get a duck migration. So some of that could be weather driven. We have definitely not have, we've been gotten thrown a few curveballs in the South, especially in the last 2, 3, 4 years during hunting season. So that can affect it too.
And if you're in a state with a very short gun season for deer, like any Midwestern state, you got a week, and that first weekend is when most of your hunters go.
Oh, yeah.
You get a rainy weekend, no one's happy.
Yeah.
You'd think that the deer hunting just went down the toilet, but.
Be better next year.
We don't have that problem here in the South.
No,
we got an
opportunity.
So let's focus here right here in the last few minutes of this. What are some of the final things you want to make sure we cover? Lanny, it looked like you might have a question too.
I do have a question. Just we can wrap it up. Or I did want to ask specifically about your preference on, we were talking about red oaks, we were talking about oak trees, and native grasses. Do you prefer to plant those in the fall or in the spring?
It would depend on where you're at.
There's the Bronson answer.
There it is. There it is.
Now, what do I say after this?
Yeah.
It would depend on where I'm at. As far as like planting oaks or planting trees, I would defer to Dudley on this question, but generally just dormant season.
Dormant season. Okay.
I mean, that's what all the tree experts always tell me. So I'm
going to listen to them. The warm season grass stuff?
Yeah. We'll
same thing?
I would do early spring.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. But the thing with like warm season grass is if you get to fall and you're like, okay, what am I going to plant in spring? Well, hold up. You need to be thinking more like the year after.
Right.
Because you've really got to be on top of it. Warm season grass planting starts the summer before with all your weed control, just because it takes so long for it to establish.
Mm-hmm.
Not that doesn't necessarily play into when you plant, but if you plant in spring, that just gives you more time to control weeds and another flush of weeds before you drill it in.
Gotcha.
So we talked about clover. It's known fact, we all like clover, everybody in here. What about like some other warm season annuals that you like to see? I'm going to assume soybeans play a role somewhere in some things y'all like. You're both nodding your head. So, and is it the forage beans that you like so much?
Whatever will grow.
Yeah, both, all, yeah. Think about the time of year and what you're wanting. So deer are going to eat the vegetative growth, the plant during the summertime. And then of course, depending on the size of the plot, your deer density, if you can then retain the grain, and so you're going to keep that warm season plot and keep it all the way into the cool season and have standing grain, all the better. But I think it really depends on forage bean or grain producing selected for bean. It all depends on, I think, the size of the plot, the deer density, and do you want standing grain in January or not?
What's the minimum size plot on beans in your mind?
Depends. I can answer that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I would say at least 10 or 15 acres. And I would also add this about the forage beans. So often people defer to forage beans as a band-aid for the bigger issue. They just don't have enough space for beans.
Right. Yeah.
That won't fix it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the other thing, Bobby, I mean, it could be 30 acres in my finding. If that's the entire perimeter to that is a fairly dense deer herd, they're going to wipe that out too. So, you know, in today's world, I think the more I've learned, I mean, there's the use of these, you know, taller portable electric fence things can really do something pretty magic because, you know, they need it so much depending on what kind of summer we have from, say, 1st of June. And that's when by far most of the antler growth is too, right?
On until well into July and early August. Yeah.
So, I mean, you could control the consumption and you can get where – you know, that's the biggest problem with beans is if they eat it when it's only gets 6 or 8 inches tall, you haven't provided that much tonnage. It's super nutritious and unbelievably palatable, but it's gone. So if you get that up and you've got a couple of feet of beans and all that tonnage, no telling me tons per acre, you can control it with that electric fence. I think that more and more people are starting to do that, and it's actually worth it simply because you can even on a small plot grow a lot of tonnage if you control the browsing early on.
Yeah. Now, Mariah, we've been having a lot of luck with we've got a blend called Protein Peas. It's got iron and clay and mung beans and that. And we've been having luck with that in smaller plots.
Yep.
And a lot of these guys that like have timber company leases and don't have big plots have been having success with that.
I think the peas and beans both are so succulent that it probably behooves everybody to get them in earlier. You know, they don't think about it till maybe after turkey season or summer's here. Oh, my gosh, I got to plant some. But the sooner you plant them, and there's so much to eat right now, you got much better chance that they survive and really make something, you know, of magnitude than if you wait too late.
Yeah.
Another strategy, and this all depends on how much food plot acreage you have. So if you just have a few logging decks on the property and you want to have that in cool season and warm season, you can't do this. But also think about alternative forages to take pressure off of those beans while you're getting them established. And so that is where the clovers can come in and the late maturing clovers. So the cool season plot over here, even though it's not cool any longer, it's still producing clover into June and some into July, taking the pressure off of those developing beans so that you can balance that out. That's just another strategy to help out as well.
Yeah.
And shoot more does.
Always.
And managing your habitat so you're also producing forage in the woods is going to help you grow soybeans as well.
Yeah.
Well, that
all makes a lot of sense.
Nothing good happens till sunlight hits the ground.
That's right.
My favorite punter, Logan Cook, he was asking, what's y'all's opinion on Milo versus corn for deer?
Is it vanilla ice cream or chocolate ice cream? They're both ice cream.
Forced to pick one, what would you go with?
Oh, corn.
Yeah, I like corn better.
And deer like a corn, isn't that what you should say?
Yeah. I mean, I can think, you know, the whole Milo, are you growing the Milo in a warm season plot so you can pair it with a vining legume? And so using that, or if you're just talking about a Milo plot for deer food or a corn plot for deer food,
right.
Yeah, corn.
Yeah, I think they like the corn better for sure.
Well, I think I've had trouble with the birds eating up my Milo really, really hard where, you know, the corn will seem to last better. The worst thing about corn is hogs we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to control that. But they'll eat everything. But it just seems like even when I grow Milo where we're going to flood for ducks, the blackbirds and stuff eat it so hard. I'd love to have more.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating to spend all that and do all that and have nothing left.
Corn it is.
All right, guys. I'm looking at y'all. We've been in here a while. We're fixing to find out how smart Mariah is. Mike has got a trivia question for you. So
Bobby has a real mean streak when it comes to these trivia questions. I'm telling you.
So Mac's been in charge the last few weeks.
Yeah, so. Let's turn it over to Mac and Richie.
He's been really good, too.
Today's trivia is brought to you by Sheffield Financial. Fuel your GameKeeper projects with financing for power sports, outdoor power equipment, and trailers. Begin your next conservation adventure at SheffieldFinancial.com.
Sheffield.
Great energy, Richie.
Yeah, Sheffield.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah.
Let's go do some Sheffield.
There's a lucky person has already won a prize. But now, and when Mac will tell you who that is, but now, if you guys get this right, y'all win a Gamekeeper podcast t-shirt.
Boom.
It's available in the merch department on our website. Isn't that
GK
right?
GK Shop. That's right.
Yeah. These are nice.
All right.
Yeah.
You know, we should probably get Bronson's face added to that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's been on so many times.
Yeah. And Mariah, we got a tank top. You'll like a tank top.
So if we were having parties here at the Gamekeeper Studio, Bronson would be the house band.
Yes, he would.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would. He sure would.
All right. So we're going to switch things up. I'm going to ask y'all a question, everybody at the table, and then we'll ask Bronson.
Mac,
and
what are you doing?
All right.
here we go.
So before I say that,
what do we win? Is that
before I say the question, Logan Mill 68 wins a box of Apex ammunition turkey shells.
Boom.
Yeah. That's a great prize.
Reach out to us and we'll get your gauge.
You need to sign Hayden up for that.
I think you can go to apexmunition.com and see all they have.
Man, those things are like 10, 12, 15 bucks a throw.
Oh, I know.
Yep.
Yeah, Hayden shot.
Awesome. Yeah, Hayden said, I just shot that last one. I was like, that was $10, bro.
All right, let's rein it in here. All right, so everybody at the table, the question is, what state was the soybean grown in the United States first?
Where was it first grown?
Where was it first grown? And if you feel dangerous, try to guess the year.
This is a tough one, Mac. We're deer people, not ag people.
Well, we're talking about warm season.
I know, you're right. Let me check my email right quick.
I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue either.
I'm going to just guess.
Well, it's not your guess.
Okay.
Oh, no, it is. It's all
everybody?
Awesome. We're supposed to answer first.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a new structure, apparently.
Just today.
Wow.
Just today.
You're not supposed to call me out on the carpet, Mac. What's going on?
Say Arkansas.
All right. Bobby's Arkansas. Dudley?
This is random, but I'm going to go with Georgia.
All right.
I'm going with Missouri.
Mr. Toxie?
I'm trying to choose between Texas and Mississippi.
I really wanted to pick Mississippi.
Mississippi would be a good answer.
You know, I'll take Mississippi.
There you go.
All right. Dudley was correct. It was in Georgia.
Yeah.
In 1765.
Wow.
And he grew it to produce soy sauce.
Oh. Huh.
All right. So there's your soybean.
So what do I get some Apex?
No.
What?
No.
You don't need any Apex.
You get 20%. You get 20% off at the retail store.
Good, wrong, Bobby.
So the next question goes to Bronson and Mariah. What country was corn cultivated in, and what was the grass that it was derived from?
Clarification.
Yes.
What country was it cultivated? Where was it first, or where is it originated from?
Where was it first originally from and used in production?
Like, where did people first grow corn?
Yeah.
These questions spawn questions.
Yeah. I know the second answer, but I don't know the first one.
I think I know the first one. I don't think I'm right.
Look at, they're whispering to each other now.
Let them talk, Bobby.
I'm just giving play-by-play for the little
It's the cultivated part I'm struggling with. I thought corn was discovered, originated in South America. So I thought that was a north.
I think you just got that right.
Hit the bell.
Yeah. What's the?
Yes.
So that's not a country, but that'll work.
Well,
right?
Mexico. South America. Yeah.
Perfect.
But yeah, it was when you said cultivated, I didn't know to what level. So were you talking about, because it was then discovered and then it went to Europe. And so then was it scaled up and planted at scale? See, I always overcomplicate questions.
Yeah. It depends.
Mexico. Yeah, it depends. Yes. Mexico.
So 9,000 years ago, you know, humans interacted with blank in the river valley in the south central Mexico.
Maize.
Yes, yeah, correct. Maize. Mm-hmm. All right. So what was the grass that they used to make corn? It wasn't corn. They hybridized it.
I knew it was grass, but I don't know where it came from. Of course, I'm not answering the question, so I don't have to worry about it.
sorghum.
It's in the Gramiaceae family.
Good. That yeah. Is, that oh, it. Yes. Teosinte.
That's it.
Nah.
Oh, that was my second
you
guess.
You missed your number.
Well, I'm not sure what just happened.
I've read a lot. I've read a lot of National Geographics.
Yeah, I'm going to call that a success for Mariah now.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. Yeah. Well, speaking of that, in Mexico, I read the article about this.
Is that a genus? What is that?
Have you seen the corn they have down there that produces some nitrogen? That's crazy.
I did
it's
hear
like
about
a gel
that.
Or something on the roots.
It's a root exudate.
Yeah, exactly. That's fascinating.
Getting over that.
No fertilizer needed because it produces its own nitrogen. It's crazy.
We need some of that.
We do need that.
I'm going to jump in here.
Come on ahead, Richie.
Mexico is it technically not in South America?
It would be Central America.
Yeah, North America, right?
Yeah, no, North America. America.
Y'all weren't even listening. He said South of America. Yeah. What is the deal?
Boy, those questions are pretty tough, Mike.
Yeah. I like them, though.
I thought Bobby was tough, but I'm sorry.
I will say Dudley got both right.
Mm. Now, Mariah, some people get Smokey and the Bandit questions.
Yeah.
And we're getting stuff like this.
Well, yeah, you're right.
Well, so, when I did a little research as to what movie you like, it was Barbara Streisand movies. I just couldn't go there, you know. So look, Bronson, you're one of our favorite guests. You know we love having you over here all the time. Mariah, it's been great to meet you. And so how can guys get in touch with you guys if they're interested
What's
in talking to
What's your cell
you?
Phone number? That's what he wants to know.
Just go to wildlifeinvestments.com, of course, if it's on from helping you with your land. And then, of course, me at the university, you just go to the MSU Deer Lab, social media or website, get in touch with me like that.
Are you in any trouble over there?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Tried to call over there the other day, and they were like...
Brunson who?
They were kind of like a little... I felt like I was getting a runaround there.
Mm.
Maybe when you get up to his level, they kind of protect him from people.
Probably
you know?
What that was.
Maybe so. Yeah. That was someone screening my calls.
That was probably Jeff Little.
I had heard a rumor that you're in a hunting club with
Dr. Mark Keenum, the president of Mississippi State University.
And there was a buck that he was wanting to kill, and you ended up killing it. Is there any truth? Can you confirm or deny that?
Total denial.
Of the university.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you kill a big deer this year?
I killed a nice deer in Texas, yes. A nice buck in Texas.
See there, Bobby. You're trying to get him in trouble.
No, I'm not. I'm trying to up his street cred a little bit.
Wait a minute.
So you're saying shooting the boss's buck is street cred? I don't know if I like that.
There's a lot.
Yeah. That's like outlaw street cred right there.
My gosh. Yeah. Outlaw is a good name for Bobby.
Yeah. All right, Bronson. Well, guys, Mac, wake up now. We put you to sleep over here. This has been interesting. We always enjoy enjoy having you over here. And Mariah, it's great to meet you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Is there anything untouched we need to make sure? Any questions, Lanny, for you on Facebook or what you're doing?
Just checking my DMs.
Yeah.
The time to have a great deer season is right now.
That's right. Yeah. Deer season starts
and
now.
To prepare yourself for it. And the time to have a great turkey season 2 years from now starts right now.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah, I planted my first food plot of the year yesterday.
You
it
did?
Got rained on. Yeah.
Perfect.
Dog.
Yeah. It's that time.
I'm behind as always.
All right, guys. We've enjoyed this one. We thank everybody for listening. It's so much fun to do these. And we take it very serious. We try to bring you the best subjects. If you guys have a question or a topic you'd like to see us talk about, just reach out to us and let us know. There was a phone number, and I can't remember what it is now, but we'll post that in the show notes.
There you go.
Yeah, Bobby, that number is 662-495-9264. Again, 662-495-9264.
All right, guys. Thank you all for being here. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Richie.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.